I really enjoyed The Boys of Winter. I was struggling to place the various authors and see who they were. I have a feeling they were an amalgam of various writers.
Well, I don't think they were even that. I think of them as essences. I wrote a book about a critic once, and people guessed various names, and in fact they got it down to a composite of three, but no, even that wasn't the case. In fact, I said it was Pauline Kael to throw people off the track, because it was a two-fisted, hard-drinking male.
Well, the Waldo, the chief writer in the book, the one who commits suicide at the end, he's kind of like a James Jones character. There are a lot of James Jones qualities in him.
Well, I think the only thing Jonesy about him is the fact that he has a great raw talent. This, at the beginning, possibly was meant to be a sort of salute to my neighbor, Jim, who, in fact, I'm afraid died in the course of writing this book. Anyway, the whole direction of the thing changed, and the Waldo character changes out of sight from Jones. Really no connection at all. You could name five authors who are more like it than...
Well, Waldo had this presence that Jones had, a commanding presence.
Oh, lots of writers have that.
Well... Some do. Jones really did, though. I mean, I knew him a little bit, and I take that back. I interviewed him toward the end of his career, and he was the kind of guy you really just wanted to go stand at a bar with. You know, he was one of these people.
Oh, he was indeed. You're right.
The Southern writer was a little bit like Willie Morris. Kind of, a little bit? No?
No. In fact, once again, you know, if you have one point of identity, people will make up the rest for you. I had a character once who happened to do broadcasting in England and America, so everybody said David Frost. There was not one other thing in common with David Frost. But just, you know, if they can catch that one handle, they'll run with it.
Well, let me see if I can get another one wrong. I think his name is Billy Van Dyne.
Yeah.
He was kind of like John Knowles.
He's even more non-existent than the others. And the characteristic of Van Dyne is that he's invisible, that nobody sees his books, sees his reviews, that he makes no mark. And Knowles is the exact opposite. He made his mark with a separate piece, and there his mark stayed. Whatever he wrote, he was the author of a separate piece. They would write that on the jacket if he wrote a note for the milkman, they would put by the author of a separate piece.
Yeah, that's all right. You know, I was talking to Sloan Wilson some time ago, and after he wrote The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, he was never successful. I think he wrote A Summer Place and one or two other books that were moderately successful. But he just didn't write anything to top The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, and I asked him about that. And he said, well, I'm very proud that I wrote The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, and if that's the only book I'd ever written and the only book that I'll ever be remembered for, I think that's a wonderful thing. And I began thinking about that, and you know, he's right.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Because you can't always top yourself.
Well, I think authors get confused when they have a success. They're not quite sure what they're supposed to do next because they weren't, you know, they weren't that self-conscious when they wrote the original book. But in fact, a lot of people live on the strength of one book. I mean, Ford Madox, Ford the Good Soldier, and what else? I think if you take Gatsby away, the whole Fitzgerald thing collapses. There's really nothing else holding it up. So, write one perfect book.
But even the perfect book is never perfect, is it?
Well, then, of course, you go over it, and then finally it gets assigned in classrooms and is never heard from again. I mean, people study it to death, at which point they can't see what it looked like the first time ever again.
Well, let's talk about some of the points that you bring up in Essays in Disguise, which is your most recent book. There are a lot of different things that are kind of fun to talk about. You describe Salinger as a humorist. I never thought of Salinger as a humorist. This was an interesting article because the author of the reputed Salinger biography, Ian Hamilton, I've interviewed a couple of times and did on the occasion of his book about Salinger, and it was an interesting book in many respects, but it really wasn't a biography in any way, shape, or form. But you address some of these points in Essays in Disguise. But let's go back. Salinger, a humorist.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of those cases. You make a statement like that, and then you feel, my God, I've probably... I'm just spitballing here. I'm making noise, and then you reread the stories, and you find that they're all very funny, and that they're funny because of tricks of phrasing and so on, which only a humorist would know. And then, of course, you check even Hamilton's data, and you find that his favorite author was Ring Lardner, and you find that he wanted Robert Benchley's job at the New Yorker, and you find that he went on seeing S. J. Perelman, and I believe still sees Peter DeVries. Well, this is every every humorist that has graced the New Yorker, and he wanted to be in the New Yorker, which was very much a magazine of humor.
Mm-hmm.
So one piece of evidence after another comes clattering out, and if you take the humor away, then the stories are rather thin.
Mm. It's so many years since I've read Salinger. He was an author of my youth. Post-college days, actually, but extremely influential. What do you say we drive up and visit him someday? Take him out for a drink.
Well, I met him once, and I played half a game of ping-pong with him, at which she is not, considering he says he played all the way through World War II, he's not frightening at ping-pong. We were, I think, tied at 10-all. And I don't know, in those days I used to write a book column for the New York Times, and I think at some point he may have begun to suspect who I was. And although we made a date to play pool that night, he didn't show up for it. So that's as close as I got. But he was living a perfectly normal life as a parent. We were both parents that weekend. And with his talking to his son and to Alan Arkin's son, who was also at the school, I heard them talking. He would say, "Oh, I'm going down to talk to some television people tomorrow, and I'll be visiting so and so." And he certainly lives a full life. I thought possibly that the TV was fantasy, but his friends agree not to talk about where he is and all that sort of thing. And there he is. I mean, Garbo lived in peace, nobody bothered her in New York. I think it's easier to do than you might suppose.
I suppose. I wonder though why. You just wonder why he turned so reclusive. But I guess it's none of our business. As I guess Ian Hamilton found out.
I think even talking about him is probably a violation. So we'll let him go at that. But
you write about in one of your essays. You write about fathers and you describe your own father as an irredeemable indoorsman. He was a publisher, wasn't he?
He was indeed, yes.
So that's where you have a literary tradition.
He would go out of doors to go to stadiums of various kinds. We saw every manner of baseball, cricket, football, rugby together, but then back into the house.
You write that he visited you at school. Of course, you were terrified at the impression he was going to make, but then you found out the other fathers were... worse.
Well, actually, what stole the show was the most gorgeous-looking mother of a boy that we hadn't paid that much attention to. She was Hungarian, it turned out. The things you don't know about the other boys in school, because everybody is variously ashamed of their parents. They're sure there's something wrong with them. But in this case, there was nothing wrong at all, except she didn't look like her mother.
Oh, I was terribly ashamed of my mother. She would get into coughing fits in public.
Mm-hmm.
She always liked pepper, you know. She would, at the dinner table, she would sprinkle pepper mm-hmm. and inevitably would start sneezing and coughing.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the movies, she would do that. It was so embarrassing.
Well, my mother had a totally unreconstructed English accent. And that was mortification enough, because the school was full of little Irish kids who mocked my accent, and then she comes in with the real thing.
What school was this?
It was a school called Del Barton, which was just beginning in New Jersey.
So and it was a prep school, huh?
Yes.
Where did you go off to college?
I wound up at Oxford.
You went to Oxford?
Mm-hmm.
Studied literature?
No, history.
Oh. But I guess the literary blood runs deep in your veins.
Well, a good many writers have studied history. I gather if you take the English course there, you never write another word. And I know that Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene both read history, or they both pretended to. I mean, both got terrible degrees, as did I.
Terrible degrees?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Well, of course, it makes no difference in this country, so I didn't fuss myself. It's very important if you're English whether you get a first class degree, second class.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, it's really A's, B's, and C's, I guess. Except the first class is a mark of genius. Only the very, very brightest get those. And if you get a third, well, that's a gentleman's, I guess. And a D means that you're fairly dense. I guess the actual formula used to be that to get a first, you had to be a friend of the tutors. To get a second, you had to work hard but not be very bright. To get a third, you had to be very bright and not work very hard. And to get a fourth, you had to be a friend of the tutors. That's the formula.
So here, I guess,
you've memorized all that.
A degree is a degree unless they look at your scholastic record.
Yeah, and then if you pay £20, or at least it must have gone up to thousands by now, but in those days, if you paid £20 and kept out of jail for another 4 years, then you got an M.A. And, of course, M.A. Oxford looks wonderful over here.
It does. Still, when you think about it, my grades were pretty iffy back in college, but as you go off into the professions, doesn't really make much difference. It makes a lot of difference the first year or two because they predicate your potential job on your academic record to a degree. But I've been out of college for 30 years or so, mm-hmm. and nobody care less whether we even have a degree.
Well, writers, of course, used to boast about how little education they had, because since it makes no difference, then of course the better you look, the more you've done it on your own.
Well, let's talk about a couple of other things in your book. Oh, one thing I wanted to mention, I thought the memoir was so touching, the one that you wrote about Jean Stafford. You got to know her very well, didn't you?
Oh, yes, indeed. I knew her before I knew her, so to speak, because she worked for my father's publishing house. And she and Robert Lowell were his most trusted employees for a little while.
Did you know Lowell as well?
Well, again, in the
I
same
think you make
sense.
A reference.
Then I came to know him as a grown-up, but at the time they were just distractions who came out to visit us, and which meant that I didn't get to see my father for the whole afternoon. So they were among the enemy at that point. But Jean remembered me very well, and was very kind to me later on. She found me a publisher without even letting me know she was doing it, and she shamelessly plugged my books. What more can you ask? So I owe her.
She was a difficult woman, though, I think you indicate.
Well, I guess she could be, but I had a sort of skeleton key because she was a Stafford, of course, and I was related to a bunch of Staffords who all looked exactly like her. They were all sarcastic in exactly the same way. And since they weren't writers, their sarcasm pretty much destroyed them, because whenever they were getting somewhere in life, they couldn't help themselves. They would say something absolutely withering, and down they'd go again. So I knew Jean all right, and if she didn't frighten you, then she delighted you. She was nothing like as frightening as Edmund Wilson. Now that was a
We mentioned a few moments ago about your moving to the United States to escape the war in Europe. But you also call that war, I think you call it the Children's War. And I also grew up during the Second World War. I had some formative years during the Second World War. And it was a wonderful war for us, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, the home front was really humming. Well, I guess I've written down the reasons, and it's always very hard to think of anything after I've written it down. It more or less, that's it and the way it goes. But I chiefly, one of my fondest memories is of owning New York. There weren't any grown-ups around, and we just scooted around. It was the safest city in the world. And I used to careen along 42nd Street. There were two Laugh movie houses in those days, so you could see the Three Stooges from morning to night. Not to mention Leon Errol and various other people. Everybody seems funny at that age.
Well, it was a very safe war. I never felt threatened, even when the air raid warden would come around. My mother had blackout drapes that she mm-hmm. would put up, so because we had to make sure all of our... This was in Ohio, I'll have you know, and mm-hmm. had to make sure that...
even safer than New
that's
York.
That's right, but we never know when a Messerschmitt might fly overhead and see the light. And,
oh, absolutely.
And strafe our street. But it was interesting. The air raid warden had the little tin hat and the flashlight. He would come around. And I would sit on my father's lap. He would draw cartoons, caricatures of Mussolini and Hitler mm-hmm. and Tojo. I mean, they were the enemy. Little truck, the pedals, and you could. It was an army truck, and it had a canvas back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful war for a kid.
Because mm-hmm.
I would look at the pictures, and I would see these children in the London Underground hiding from the bombs. And in a way, I kind of envied them. They always looked so safe in that underground. But I was even safer. And it was Ohio nights with the lightning bolts.
Yeah, of course, little did we know that if the war had gone on another couple of years, the Germans would actually have been throwing missiles at us.
Yeah.
It came as a terrible shock to the English, and it was apparently the most demoralizing part of the war was when the missiles began to land. You know, they'd been rather priding themselves on their pluck and all that and seeing out the Blitz. And then this thing, which was doubly spooky, because when you heard them, you knew you were safe. So it was just before you heard them that you were in danger. So people were jumping around. I think there's a movie called The Green Man where Alistair Sim keeps diving into ditches whenever he suspects one of these damn things is coming. I guess maybe you heard a whistle like a tea kettle somewhere in the distance. And that was just around the corner when the war ended.
Yeah. I remember the ration stamps that we used to have to use, and my father would complain bitterly that booze was rationed and cigarettes and so forth. And the day the war ended, he went to the little cigarette shop in his office building, and the man who ran the shop opened the back door to a warehouse, and it was mm-hmm. crammed with liquor and cigarettes, and my father reached the conclusion there never was a shortage.
Of course not. The other thing about the war was you were never the only passenger in a car. I remember it was, as a little fellow taking taxis with my parents, and you'd get them outside whatever station it was, and the taxi driver would wait until the cab was absolutely full to groaning before taking off, because the gas rationing was the one that was felt the most. Anybody who had stamps, my God, a doctor was the most prized man in the community. You'd always be trying to get on his good side just to haggle a ride into anywhere. But in the city, of course, none of this mattered, because public transport had the streets to itself, so that if you took a bus, you were downtown in 20 minutes from anywhere.
Well, back to Essays in Disguise, the teapot papers, you talk about English tea, somewhat overrated, I believe.
Well, I decided every now and then you have to write a silly column. It's just sort of airing out the room. And this was my venture for the year. And yes, why not? Because the English do carry on intolerably about their tea. My mother would, too. My mother couldn't cook a sausage, but nevertheless, when it came to tea, my God, the Americans did it wrong, and she did it right. And in fact, what they do is make the first cup right, and then they keep pouring hot water onto this mess. And it's finally tepid and stewed and unspeakable. But they haven't used a tea bag.
They don't use tea bags at all, huh?
I never thought I'd find myself talking about this. All the subjects in the world. But anyway, no, they do use tea bags now. And
it's your fault now, Mr. Shee. Do you have that in your book?
Oh, I have all sorts of things in the book.
Yes, you do. You talk about everything from Sinatra to popular music. Popular music is very important to you, isn't it?
Yes, that's a running theme. My sister and I used to listen to the Hit Parade. There were only two things that made any sense to me when I first got here. One was baseball, which made sense instantly, and the other was music. And I think I took to memorizing every song I ever heard, and I'm still afflicted with all these songs that I would sing if anybody ever asked, but I don't have a voice to go with this, so...
Yeah, there was a day you could listen to the Hit Parade and know all the songs in the top 40, but today you turn on the radio, I can't recognize a note.
I don't even know which of the ones I'm supposed to be listening to now.
I'm baffled. I'm completely lost. I'm caught in a time warp. I think my last encounter with real American popular music was probably 1959, maybe 60.
In those days, as I recall, it was a sort of shared language, and so if you took a girl out and you were unspeakably shy, you might easily wind up singing because the band would play something that you both knew and you'd sing along, and this would be a primitive communication might conceivably lead to conversation if you kept at it long enough.
Well, yes, and also
every couple had a song.
That's right. Song that they heard when they first met. Nice thing about the songs of the 30s and the 40s and 50s, you could actually understand the words.
Well, the words are handy to memorize, but I've never paid any attention to what they mean. I sometimes find I've been singing a song for 30 years without ever thinking, oh, that's what it means. I just find them handy mnemonics, so it's not, I'm interested in the tunes, oddly enough.
Mersey Doach, you don't know what that means?
That's an easy one.
A hot set song.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that one? A hot set song. Freddie Martin.
Yes, so I remember everything.
You collect records?
I used to. When I went back to England after the war, I was terribly homesick for New York, and again, the only link that held up was music. So I used to. I went through a Gershwin phase. I bought every Gershwin thing I could find. I also bought everything by Benny Goodman that I could find, particularly the trio and quartet.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, those records were made of some kind of chalk. Everything in England was made out of something, ersatz, powdered milk, powdered eggs, even powdered records. So they all crumbled in a year or two, and I don't have a record collection.
Well, they're easily replaceable.
Oh, now, of course, you can get the whole thing on one record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to take a whole album of these 10 inches to produce what would be one side now.
You probably like the Dennis Potter.
You paid a lot more attention because you were constantly changing records.
Yeah. Probably like the Dennis Potter television productions, don't you, with the terrific use of music?
Yes, I thought that this was... stark realism when I first saw Pennies from Heaven, because I always hear a song come, you know, a scene will suggest a song to me, but I've never actually seen it acted out for me, but yes. And there's nearly always a song entering my head or leaving it. And in fact, when they get stuck, you have to, when one song won't go away, I simply have to get another song to drive it away. And this can go on all day.
IQ. Apparently, IQ ratings are overrated, if that's the phrase.
Oh, well, what I say about IQ is sort of mixed. I do think the thing exists, and I do think it actually does measure something, which is probably worth measuring. And I was actually getting into a debate. Someone, a man called Jensen, wrote a monograph on IQ, which... among its many, many findings, suggested that some races had higher IQs than others. And this is, of course, a very serious subject, not to be treated too lightly, but I treat what I can lightly. And the racial aspect is, in fact, a very small one, but if you are going to go with it, in fact, Orientals have higher IQs than white Americans, so we have nothing to be proud of. And what it measures is rather limited. But some people were so hysterical about this finding that they began denying that IQ existed at all. And you can only force evidence a certain amount. The suggestion that intelligence is not inherited would make it the only part of the body that is not, make the brain the only part that is not. Mm-hmm. And IQ does deal with the inheritance. But it, as I say, doesn't go terribly far. I think there are a good many geniuses without any IQ to speak of.
Yeah, I think you point out in that particular essay that someone with a relatively low IQ who works extremely hard can be a tremendous success. Our writers don't have to be geniuses to learn how to write with skill and
IQ is really a form of acrobatics. It means you can leap from this to that. You can make quick associations and so on. But very, very useful gifts, but not the whole Megillah, or not even the big Megillah.
Well, back to writers. In another essay you talk about, I think you use the phrase, the 20-year itch, in which you state something to the effect that writers seem to do their best work within a small period of time. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah, I got the notion from Kurt Vonnegut, who is always watching his own clock very carefully, and he figures that you can start at any point. If you start writing at 50, you still get 20 years. And I don't know on what mystical insight this is based, except just experience, that if you simply check all the writers you can think of. But then I began applying it to other professions, and I think 20 absolutely top years is the most you can hope for in a lot of fields. And I thought of all the burned out doctors and burned out lawyers, and they've burnt out just at the point where they've become famous. I think it's most notably the case in architecture, where you start out as a junior, providing some great man with ideas. You know, you work around Frank Lloyd Wright's. Well, Frank Lloyd Wright's an exception, perhaps, but because he never had time to build all the buildings he'd thought of by the age of 20. But in most cases, you will find that there's some superstar of an architect who hasn't had an idea in years, and you're providing his designs. By the time you're a superstar yourself, you won't have had an idea in years. And so it goes. And I think that whenever you hear about a distinguished professional at some business or other, you can figure that his best years are behind him.
Yet James Jones worked right down to the wire, didn't he?
James Jones had a demonic burst of energy as he was dying. And it seemed in his case that he had a special dispensation whenever he wrote about the army and that particular gang, that was ever fresh to him. I guess it's possible to take some time out in the middle of your 20 years. This would be the case with Tolstoy, where he wrote his masterpieces and then nothing of any note, and then came back thunderingly.
I picked up a copy of Some Came Running a while ago and tried to read it again, and it was impossible.
Yeah,
just couldn't read it. I was so thrown off by the grammar and by the punctuation, strange punctuation. Just wonder how he was allowed to get away with that.
He had trouble with civilian life. Well, if you become important enough, you get away with whatever you want to get away with. But of course, he'd lost Max Perkins, who was his early inspiration. However, he continued to have good editors, but. If you've had a success, you know best, and you do it your way.
I suppose. I was reading a copy of the I think it's called The Widowmaker by Jones some time ago, and although we're digressing a little bit, I just want to tell you this story. As I was reading, it was a pretty good book. I enjoyed it. It was, if you read the book, you know, set in the Caribbean, has a lot about deep sea diving, and a relationship with between a writer and an older woman, very much like Jones' own life. But as I was reading, I would come across certain parts. I could have sworn I had read it before, but then I thought, I must have lost my place. And then I began to realize that he was repeating himself throughout that book. That book would have been a really good book had his editor chopped about half of it and created a greater focus. There was so much repetition. It would have been a better book had he had a more skillful editor. But I would assume that maybe the editor was intimidated.
I once saw one of Jim's manuscripts, and various suggestions had been made rather timidly by the editor. In each case, he'd written Stet alongside it. So I said, is it because you want it to be your words and nobody else's that you always put Stet? And he said, no, it's because I was right every time. And he winked at me, but nevertheless, I think that was the proposition that he worked under, that if he couldn't trust himself, then who could he trust? And of course, then again, it's very hard to find an editor that you do put that much confidence in. He knew that his instincts had gotten him where he was, and that they were better than anybody else's. And of course, when he got back to the army, it was indeed so. Just to get back to the 20-year thing for a moment, it's not completely airy-fairy. I think it's just an amount of intensity you can bring to a particular line of work. And as I say in the essay, you can possibly switch lines of work or switch your focus within a line of work, take up a new specialty, and then the meter starts running all over again.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think if you examine your own profession, you'll find that some slight shift at a certain point. I don't want to sound like a gypsy advisor. Some slight shift is indicated. I don't mean anything like that.
No, I agree with you. You know an awful lot of writers. What's it like being part of this literary establishment?
Well, American writers only know each other glancingly. We don't go from coffee house to coffee house in the Parisian manner. I think American writers are loners. We glance off each other, sort of view each other with suspicion mixed with admiration, and wonder how the other fellow's doing. Hope he's not doing too well.
Hang out at Jimmy's?
Well,
probably Tommy Vann's.
No, Bobby Vann's. No, that's the one thing that I didn't bother to make up, although I certainly made up the proprietor. But otherwise, no, you have to have a setting, and you can't lie about everything.
You still hang out there?
Yes, I do. We don't have too many of the old writers left. Willie Morris has indeed left us, gone south, and Jim is dead, alas. Jack Knowles isn't around very much. No, we haven't got much. And, of course, Truman Capote, a shadowy presence, he'd come there when he was drying out, and everybody would leave him alone. Talk about how easy it is to be left alone in this country. He would sit at his own table, and it was as if he wasn't there. It was a conspiracy not even to look at him.
So what's happening? Long Island is losing its literary roots now?
Well, we used to have struggling writers, and now we only have successful writers.
They can afford it.
Yes, exactly. And it's a very different atmosphere once you have that. But we have some pretty good writers. Bruce J. Friedman hangs out. Joe Heller.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly enjoy these essays and your other work, The Boys of Winter, was absolutely hilarious, although it got a little heavy toward the end. I don't know if you anticipated it. Did you say you did anticipate that ending or did not?
I'm sorry, The Boys of Winter?
Yeah.
I knew what was coming. And it seems now to have been a tactical mistake. People felt it was too heavy for the book, which means I hadn't done my work properly because, to my mind, it was always a rather heavy book. I considered this a rather dark subject. But if you put in too many jokes along the way, people assume that it's a joke book. And I was somewhat annoyed that they gave me a joke jacket, too, a joke cover, because that certainly said this is going to be a laugh riot, fellows. In fact, everything is wrong about that cover. I don't want to pick on the artist because he's a very good man, but these are not middle-aged men out of shape. They don't have sagging Bermudas or whatever they have in there. These are reasonable-looking people.
It's saying an awful lot about publishing, which I found interesting. But you do take a risk, don't you, in writing about something so special? I mean, you're talking about writers as heroes. I just wonder if, you know, me
well, that's why I talk about writing about essences, because the essence of everything is interesting. As I had to get back to my critic, who wasn't anybody in particular, that critic came simply from being a critic myself for a number of years and hanging out. And finally you get a sense of this is what a critic is. You know, it's a sort of platonic sense of the critic in the sky. And that's who I write about. And this is also, of course, these are very gregarious writers. These are writers with personalities. They're not... I've often wondered, and changed the subject slightly, if you put a great number of writers of all kinds in a room without identity tags, and you had somebody from a totally alien civilization or planet, if possible, and asked him to rate the writers, who he would think were the best writers, simply by looking at them, and the surprises would be immense. Bernard Malamud could not be a great writer to look at. or to talk to.
He's a dentist.
Well, a bank clerk, I don't know. But whatever he was a giant when he wrote, but not when he when one talked to him. On the other hand, some totally second-rate people, you'd say, oh, yeah, he must be a great poet with all that curly hair and all, and his pipe. And he wouldn't be a poet at all. He'd be the plumber.
Well, Wilfred Sheed, I'm delighted to have the chance to talk to you. We're out of time. I've got to move on, and you do too. I want to get your car before you have to get it out of the pound. let's hope for the best. It was terrific. I wanted to talk to you for a long time. I thank you very, very
well,
much.
Well, you didn't ask any conventional questions, so I didn't have any prepared answers.
What were the conventional questions?
Oh, why do you call them essays? Why don't people read essays? Please don't ask them now. I haven't gotten this far without it.